of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and airstrikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and airstrikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the Brazen Act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions. Clearly, those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
The political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year, when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been re-established with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar, and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on. And one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They're two nations that are in a very strategic area who bordered the Gulf region, bordered the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom, or the European Union, or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal-left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party, or the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. She left very popular, which is very important. Clearly, Germans liked her steady, somewhat conservative leadership, and she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. After Brexit, people became frightened and decided, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. The EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy. But their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to Parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has not acquitted herself especially well. And that includes the Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of istihada and fluid discharge, which is the topic today and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men.
He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Zawid, we are talking about the different kinds of discharge, like irregular and regular discharge. Usually irregular discharge that you defined it as istihada. According to the laws, in fact, released by Ayatollah Sistani, let me start this episode with this question that whether it is permissible or not for a lady in the state of istihada to enter a mosque. Is she allowed to enter any mosque, or even particularly, one of the most important, or maybe the most important mosque in the world of Islam, Masjid al-Nabi?
Obviously, it is permissible for a woman in the state of istihada or irregular blood to enter a mosque, including the mosque of the Holy Prophet, which is known as Masjid al-Nabi, of course, because as long as a woman can pray, she can enter any holy places, and she is allowed to enter a mosque, to pause in a mosque, to halt, to stay. And there's no difference in the mosque, all in any mosque, whether it is a local mosque or whether it is the holiest mosque, including the mosque of the Prophet, which you named. Now, she can recite the Holy Quran, and she can engage in any kind of religious activities which a normal woman can, you know. But we should know, our dear sisters should understand the fact that there is a difference between istihada and haidh, of course. Istihada means the irregular blood which a woman discharges off and on sometimes, of course. And haidh is the regular monthly period. Obviously, in the state of haidh, a woman is not allowed to do any of these. She cannot enter a mosque. She cannot touch the script of the Holy Quran, and she cannot recite the verses which contain the obligatory sajdas, and she cannot, of course, enter the Masjid al-Nabi in Masjid al-Haram, of course, the Kaaba, of course. It is absolutely forbidden for a woman in the state of menstruation, monthly period, to enter those two holy mosques, Masjid al-Nabi, in Masjid al-Haram, of course. Those are the two holiest places. Now, in the state of nifas, all of those acts are permissible.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Sheikh Javid, if a woman discharges fluid, yellowish fluid,
yes,
all right, does she have to count it as istihada or anything else?
yellowish fluid does not mean that it is blood, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a kind of yellowish blood fluid, but it may not be mixed with blood.
Yes.
And of course, a woman can see it for herself. If she knows that there's no blood in the fluid, then that fluid is not considered to be istihaza, okay?
Yes.
She can just wash herself, and she doesn't need to take any other action. She is not supposed to perform one wudu for every single prayer. But if it is mixed with blood, of course, mm-hmm. then, of course, she has to act according to the rules of istihaza. She should follow the rules of istihaza depending on the amount of blood. If the amount is little, she has to follow the rules of qalil istihaza. If the amount is medium, she has to follow the rules of mutawassita istihaza. And then the next one, which is excessive istihaza. So depending on the type and the quantity of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker at the studio. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, some women discharge yellowish or brownish fluid before or after the regular monthly period. Then what are the Islamic laws about this? How should women go about them?
Well, there's a difference between yellowish or brownish fluid that a woman discharges before the regular monthly bleeding or after the monthly bleeding, which is called haiz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the yellowish blood or the yellowish fluid or the brownish fluid appears before the monthly period, then according to Ayatollah Sistani, that yellowish or brownish fluid is not considered to be a part of haiz. It's not considered to be a part of the regular monthly period.
Mm.
So, but if it is discharged after the regular bleeding, for example, a woman discharges yellowish blood on the sixth day or on the fifth day or on the seventh day, the blood which is discharged or the yellowish fluid which is discharged until the 10th day of the haiz is considered to be part of the regular monthly blood,
mm-hmm.
you know, until the 10th day. And so it is there's a difference between discharging blood before the regular monthly period or after. The yellowish fluid which comes after the regular bleeding is considered to be part of the haiz, but if it appears or it is discharged before the regular menstrual period, it is not considered to be part of the haiz.
Shaykh, what about the blood observed, in fact, in or during pregnancy for a woman? Is this istihada or something else?
Well, people are under the impression that when a woman becomes pregnant, then she no longer sees the menstrual blood. She mm-hmm. no longer gets that period, the monthly period. And therefore, if a woman discharges blood, they think that this is not the blood of haiz. While it's not the case, and the Islamic Sharia says that a woman who is pregnant can still menstruate. She can have the menstrual discharge. Okay, mm-hmm. She can have the monthly period. So depending on the amount and the amount of blood, if a woman, a pregnant woman, discharges blood for 3 days or more, for let's say for up to 10 days, the blood which she discharges, even if she is pregnant, that blood is considered to be the blood of Hayz. It's called menstrual discharge, menstrual blood. But if it is less than 3 days, then that is considered to be istihal.
I see. Sheikh Javid, can women in their menses or even in the state of istihala recite the Holy Quran?
Obviously, in the state of istihala, a woman can do all acts of worship, including reciting the Holy Quran, praying, fasting, performing hajj, circumambulating, and all of these activities are allowed in the state of istihala.
Even the verses that necessitate prostration?
Yeah, of course, she is allowed to do, because when she can pray, she can also recite the Holy Quran. Okay. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the monthly regular monthly period or bleeding, of course, a woman who is menstruating and who is discharging menstrual blood cannot recite those verses of the Quran which include the obligatory sajda. Unlike Ayatollah Sistani, other religious authorities are of the view that a woman cannot recite the whole chapter. The whole chapter. But Ayatollah Sistani says no, she can recite the chapter, but she cannot recite those verses. Many religious scholars, as far as I know, are of the view that she cannot even recite one letter from that chapter, which includes an obligatory sajda. But Ayatollah Sistani is not of that view. He says that she can recite the whole chapter except that verse which includes sajda wajib or an obligatory sajda.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe I can ask you this one last quick question, Sheikh Javid.
Yes.
Well, can women in their, let's say, state of istihala, or even the state of hayz,
sure,
wear precious stones with rings, necklaces, or gold ornaments on which some of the holy names have been engraved?
You're right. Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's permissible for a woman who is in the state of istihaza or hayz or nifas to wear all of these gold ornaments, even if they are, even if holy names are engraved on them. But it's not necessary, it's not permissible, of course, it's not permissible for a woman to touch those names. You see? Touching those names is absolutely forbidden. But if she's wearing, and if the names happen to touch her body, there's no problem. She cannot use her hands to touch those names.
I see.
Okay. Because the necklace is there, and she's wearing what they call it, locket or something. I'm not sure. The name is there, and it's hanging there. It touches her body, there's no problem because she's not doing it deliberately, but she cannot touch the name using her fingers or hands.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Again, we are here to present with another episode of A Muslim Lady, where we have been discussing so many important issues regarding Muslim lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studios, my wife, Razia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm just thanking Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala to having this great opportunity. It's a biggest way of worshipping Allah. Thank you so much.
So, inshallah, today we are going to discuss about a very important and interesting topic, you know, which is the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali. Yeah, you know, this great man, how much changes he has brought in our society, in Muslim society, and one of it is regarding our Muslim lady.
Yeah, the moment you said Imam Khomeini, everyone knows about his revolution about this country, Iran. But I usually say the revolution was from inside the human kind throughout the world. And especially he was a big blessing of Allah for us as a Muslim practicing ladies. Until now, I'm just thanking Allah that Allah has given me life, and my life was in this era, in this time, because the freedom, the respect, the rights, which as a Muslim lady, I myself have experienced because of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. I don't think so I would have that many blessings in other times.
Yeah, especially from the West, they were thinking that Islam does not care about the rights of women, yeah? Because of so many Muslim, so-called Muslim countries, because we, even nowadays, we see that no any right of Muslim ladies or our women is taken care of. So somehow he has given a very good practical answer to the criticism of, you know, Western societies. That so Islam is, limits, you know, Islam, if you accept Islam, it means you are limited. You can't do social activities, you know, you can't play any role in your society. So by bringing revolution in this part of the world and giving freedom to Muslim ladies, he has answered them, you know, practically answered them, and he has shut their mouths closed, you know, beautifully. So look at this, you know, modern Islamic Republic of Iran, where women play role shoulder by shoulder to gents and males.
No doubt.
And having their own hijab, having their own chastity, modesty. So this is the true Islam. So all this credit goes to the great personality of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali. I just want to mention a quote from him that he says, "My daughter,
all the prophets have come to, you know, elevate all the human beings. And they have come to remove all the curtains, all the obstacles. So by saying this, he wants to say that Islam does not put any hijab or curtain in front of you, you know. You can go through all these progress in your life. Spiritually, you can play your role in your society. So how beautifully he describes. It means that in that time, he was a very open-minded and very, very intelligent person. Because in his society, when he was studying in the Islamic seminary of Najaf, you know, there wasn't any facility for women to study.
Oh, yeah, I have heard. You know, therefore, we can realize his role and his very revolutionary mindset, you know, because like Najaf is also, until now, it's a center of knowledge. It's a Muslim, Shia, you know, city, definitely very holy city. And Qom is also. I think because, you know, you can see all the beautiful attributes of prophets and messengers of Allah in this great man. Because if you study Islam, you always see Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala, he has started the journey of guidance for us mankind from Adam and Hawa. So both are there, Adam and Hawa. Both, they went to Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala to repent. Both have done Tawbah. And Allah has accepted Tawbah from both of them. Although Adam, alayhi salam, is a prophet. But Hawa's role as a spiritual role model is still there. And then if you come, you know, along to the time of Prophet Ibrahim, you can see Sarah, the role of Lady Hajra. You can see the role of, in the time of Moses, the role of the mother and the sister. And Lady Asiya and Lady Maryam, you know, the wonders are there. So you cannot neglect the role of women, which Allah has given. And prophets are the protector of that role. And after prophet, the great scholars, especially like Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi.
Yeah, definitely. And you can see how in the era of our Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, how the women, the great ladies, they played their role. So, which means Islam has provided equally the rights to our, ladies and male. They can both play, but yeah, they have priorities.
Yeah. You know, whenever people, they talk about the equality, I say, why it shouldn't be equal? Why? You know, this I have learned from the school thought of Imam Khomeini, which is the school thought of Quran and Ahlul Bayt. So, because, you know, we as a human being, we are made of soul and body. And our soul cannot be divided to male and female, but our body can be divided. So the division comes when something we have to play our responsibility duties in this world. Yeah, physical world. But the spiritually, the connection to Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala and the level and standard of understanding the concept of God, you know, those the main, the very supreme, you know, ideologies.
Women in Imam Khomeini's idea.
When talking about the infant of Islam and the spiritual disposition of the infant, Imam Khomeini observes that you should know that Islam incorporates all things before marriage occurs between a woman and a man until the time they are laid to rest. Islam has canons, it has teachings, it has progressive instructions, which are useful for man's happiness, both in this world and in the afterlife. Sahifa Ya Imam, Volume 6, page 191.
We are talking about the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali. The Quran also says whenever it talks about the spiritual journey, the nearness to Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala, it does not mention male or female. It says, Inna akramakum indallahi atqakum.
No doubt.
You know, whoever is more pious, he is closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is more honorable. He is more respectful. Throughout all these verses of the Holy Quran, we cannot find a single verse which differentiates between men and female. Except those, you know, inheritance or whenever it comes to, you know, physical things, then it says that your female rights are these and their inheritance is like this.
That is for this world, you know, like
the, and limited issues. Exactly. Otherwise, generally speaking, the Holy Quran never ever differentiates between
I love
men
one story. Yeah, Khalada, this says, you know, that the mindset of prophets and Imam Khomeini. Khalada, she was a lady, normal lady, okay? So Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala asked Prophet Dawood to go and visit Khalada because she would be in your company in heaven, in Jannah. So Prophet Dawood went to the house of Khalada. He knocked the door and he said, "Are you Khalada bint Uwais?" She said, "Yes, I am." And then he said, "I'm a prophet. Allah has sent me to your house." She said, "How come you are coming to my house? You know, there should be any name mistake. I'm not an extraordinary person. This is a wrong address." But he said, "No, this is right address. Can you just tell me your habits, your lifestyle?" She said, "Nothing I have special." Look, that kind of humbleness, you know. So she said, "Nothing. People, they would think that I'm suffering a lot from so many problems. But yeah, I know those are tests. And I'm so much satisfied by distribution of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. So I'm always happy, you know. I'm satisfied." So the way she was so much humble, down to earth, and full of contentment, Prophet Dawood, he said, "Yeah, you are the person. You know, Allah has observed and Allah bought this quality because Allah, we are selling our life to Allah. Inna Allah ashtara." So Allah is buying and Allah is appreciating the quality of humbleness, you know, honesty and satisfaction. So those qualities are important, not a person. So she's a lady, you know. But look at the concept of Islam and Quran and Prophet, that a lady or a man, whoever has that quality, Allah is just
no
elevating
matter,
the status.
So until our next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah,
Muhammad is the messenger to Allah. The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
In the limelight. The House of Representatives Committee laid out its case for a contempt of Congress charge against Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of former President Donald J. Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Emily Cochrain. The piece is titled, Meadows Was Deeply Involved in Fighting Election Outcome, January 6th panel says. The House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol released a report on Sunday, 12th of December, that laid out its case for a contempt of Congress charge against Mark Meadows, the chief of staff to former President Donald J. Trump, presenting evidence of Mr. Meadows' deep involvement in the effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. In the 51-page document, the House Committee said it wanted to question Mark Meadows about an email he had sent a day before the attack, advising that the National Guard would be used to defend Trump supporters. The House panel said it also wants to ask him about an exchange with an unnamed senator about rejecting electors for Joseph R. Biden Jr. Mark Meadows had been cooperating with the committee's investigation, but he refused to appear for a scheduled deposition last week or to turn over additional documents, citing Donald Trump's assertion of executive privilege. The House committee, which is controlled by Democrats, is slated to vote on Monday to recommend a contempt of Congress charge against him for his refusal to cooperate with its subpoena. That charge carries a penalty of up to a year in jail. Before coming to loggerheads with the House panel, Mark Meadows provided more than 9,000 pages of records to the committee. The information they contained raised additional questions, the panel said. Among the emails and text messages that Mark Meadows turned over were the following, the House panel said. A 7th of November email that discussed an attempt to arrange with state legislators to appoint slates of pro-Trump electors instead of the Biden electors chosen by the voters. Mr. Meadows' text messages also showed him asking members of Congress how to put Donald Trump in contact with slate legislators. Text messages Mark Meadows exchanged with an unidentified senator in which he recounted Donald Trump's view on Vice President Mike Pence's ability to reject electors from certain states. Donald Trump thinks the legislators have the power, but the vice president has power too, Mr. Meadows wrote. A 5th of January email in which Mark Meadows said the National Guard would be present at the Capitol on 6th of January to protect pro-Trump people. emails from Mr. Meadows to Justice Department officials on 29th of December, 30th of December, and 1st of January, in which he encouraged investigators of voter fraud, including allegations already rejected by federal investigators and by courts of law. Text messages Mark Meadows exchanged with members of Congress as violence engulfed the Capitol on 6th of January, in which lawmakers encouraged him to persuade Donald Trump to discourage the attack, as well as a text message sent to one of the president's family members in which Mark Meadows said he was pushing hard for Donald Trump to condemn this. Text messages reflecting Mr. Meadows' private skepticism about some of the wild public statements about allegations of widespread election fraud and compromised voting machines that were put forth by Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell is a lawyer working with Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. The committee also said it had a number of questions prompted by Mr. Meadows' new book, The Chief's Chief, and cited it as evidence that his refusal to testify was untenable. Mr. Meadows has shown his willingness to talk about issues related to the Select Committee's investigation across a variety of media platforms, anywhere it seems, except to the Select Committee, the panel wrote. The House Committee said it also had questions about why Mr. Meadows had used a personal cell phone, a Signal account, and two personal Gmail accounts to conduct official business, and whether he had properly turned over all records from those accounts to the National Archives. The report comes as the committee is scrutinizing a 38-page PowerPoint document containing plans to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. That document, which Mark Meadows provided to the committee, urged Donald Trump to declare a national emergency to cling to power and included an unsupported claim that China and Venezuela had obtained control over the voting infrastructure in a majority of U.S. states. Mark Meadows' lawyer has said he provided the document to the committee because he had received it by email and did nothing with it. Phil Waldron, a retired Army colonel who has promoted false claims of election fraud, said that he had circulated the document among Donald Trump's allies and among lawmakers on Capitol Hill in the days just before the mob violence on 6th of January. Rudolph Giuliani has identified Mr. Waldron as a source of information for his legal campaign. Phil Waldron told the Washington Post that he had visited the White House several times after last year's election and spoken with Mark Meadows maybe 8 to 10 times.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Thank you.
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: تكلموا تعرفوا، فإن المرء مخبوء تحت لسانه.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Speak so that you may be known, since man is hidden under his tongue."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find in the historical texts that the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, was truly a comprehensive persona, and it was a persona who was modeled after the persona of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. We find that one of the living miracles of the Holy Prophet was Lady Fatima Zahra, peace and blessings upon her, and of course Imam Ali, his successor and the first divinely appointed Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. And we find that this persona is truly a beautiful persona. But how can you gauge a person's persona, a person's character and personality? Well, one of the ways is via their actions, and another way is via their words. And what we see in the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them, the divinely appointed Imams, is that their words and their actions were united and in unison with one another. They were inseparable. They said what they did, and they did what they said. Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about a certain kind of individual. He talks about this idea of the difference between two individuals. Of course, as Islam says, the difference or the superiority from one human being to another human being is not race or religion or ethnicity or nationality or color, or social status or place of birth, etc. Everybody is equal. The superiority comes when we talk about taqwa, one who is more God-conscious, one who is more pious, one who follows and obeys the laws of Allah more, the one who is the best servant and slave and creation of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And so along these lines, Imam Ali says that one who has redeemed himself and then set free is never like one who sells himself and then sets himself.